Okay, last week the question was asked to me, what is an example? I mentioned that there are philosophical principles that we are deriving here in the Talmudic interpretation, and there are psychological principles also. And the question was asked, what exactly do I mean by philosophical and psychological? So I would just like to give examples from the things that we actually took up. For instance, we left off last week with the concept of speech being the main instrument of seduction. And this, of course, is an important psychological principle, where what the prophet is teaching us, Jeremiah, by that word, placing that word lamar, that verbal saying, in that position before he starts his parable about the woman who is unfaithful, is to teach us the concept that flirtation and speech is really the essence of of intercourse between man and woman. And that there's no such thing, in other words, as a harmless flirtation. That's why this is an important principle. It's a psychological principle, that man is essentially a psychological being, and he often doesn't realize that he feels that, well, these are just a few harmless words. I'm just going to engage in some harmless flirtation. So here the Torah teaches us a psychological principle that is not true, that there are very powerful forces behind that speech, and being unaware of this is harmful to the person, because the person will get involved in something in a deeper way than he realizes, and will not be able to turn away once he is involved. So that's why, for instance, the rabbis say one should not speak much, should not talk a lot with a woman. This is referring to a certain type of talk, a flirtatious talk, that a person must be wary of this type of speech and not look at it as just something harmless. That's what the prophet is teaching us, and that the essence of the person's sexual expression is in the verbal. Man is different than the animal in that sense. And this is endorsed several places in the Torah, for instance, by Joseph, where it tells you about the seduction with the wife of Potiphar. So there the Torah says, and it was as she spoke with Joseph each day. Okay, that's 39:10. So the speech, again, is emphasized, that the power, the seductive power of speech. This would be an example of a psychological point, of psychological insight that the Torah gives. And so far as an example of the, I can give you something we just took up recently as an example of both the philosophical and the psychological. We were speaking about the concept of self-gratification through sexual fantasy. And there we said that it is not, according to the Torah, perfection, because it is God's will that man should live in reality, and the Torah really despises fantasy on any level where a person engages in fantasy, and that is his sole objective. That is an escape from reality, and that is against the philosophy of the Torah. So there you have a philosophical principle, but it is also a psychological principle, because the Torah maintains that it is not good for an individual on a psychological plane either, since he is really structured for reality psychologically, and it would be a frustrating experience and an unhealthy experience for his psyche. As a matter of fact, no less a psychologist than Sigmund Freud came to the same exact conclusion. And he was against self-gratification through sexual fantasy. So, but he was speaking totally from a psychological point of view, that it is not good for the person to escape from reality into the world of fantasy. That's not healthy from a psychological standpoint. The Torah is speaking from a philosophical standpoint that is not, does not lead to philosophical perfection, but it also is true psychologically. It is not good for the person's psyche. So the Torah, again, there you see, that's an example of both philosophical and psychological. Okay, as we continue, I'll continue to point out, whether we're discussing something which is philosophical or psychological or both. We're up to, in this verse, in Genesis, we're up to the fifth, I believe, the fifth component of that verse. It's a remarkable verse, as I mentioned before, because it naturally breaks down into seven components. And it also is the verse, as we mentioned before, which indicates man's higher abilities, that of intelligence. So it's Genesis 2:16. Okay. Now, if you just take out, we're counting here verbs, we're counting nouns, and we're counting also, we call in grammar verbals, saying. Saying is called a participle, it's a verbal. We are not counting prepositions, like about or on the man, about the man. That we're not counting. But if you minus out, there's only, actually in this verse in Hebrew, there's only one preposition. Preposition, of course, goes together with the noun that it follows, which is man. So, except for the preposition, every one of these words, nouns and verbs, break down to, it breaks down to seven components. All right? Also, the now we're going to take so far. Let me take the last two, okay? All right. The last two is we have from all the trees of the garden. That's one, because again, we're not counting from and all. We're just counting the noun, which is the trees of the garden. So that breaks down to one component again. And then the last two words, actually the last verb, but it's double in Hebrew, you may eat. But it says, the way it's written in Hebrew is, eating, you may eat. Okay? So here we have two remaining components in this verse. And now we're going to explain what those two components represent in terms of the seven laws. Okay? Now, this is what the Talmud says. The Talmud says, from all the trees of the garden, okay, so the Talmud says, and not from that which is stolen, not from anything stolen. Okay, now how do we derive that? I mean, what does the Talmud mean over here? So Rashi explains that God, when he gave this prohibition to man to eat from the tree of knowledge, he did not have to say, you can eat from all the trees of the garden, except for this one. He simply should have said, don't eat from the tree of knowledge. Why did he say, you may eat from all the other trees? There's an implication here. And the implication is that without God's permission, he couldn't eat anything. All right? So when God approached man, he said, in essence, I am giving you permission to eat from all the trees of the garden, but this last tree, I am not giving you permission to eat from. Okay? The derivation is a very natural one. In other words, because the Torah is clear that God had to give man permission to eat from the trees in general, it means that man has no right to eat from those trees unless God gives him permission. Okay. Now, this is an important concept, and here we have a philosophical concept, and philosophical and as opposed actually to ethical. I'll explain to you what I mean. How does this tell us that you cannot eat from that which is stolen? Okay. amazes us out that ordinarily people understand the violation of stealing as being one which is a violation based upon ethics, meaning that I cannot steal from my fellow man because it's not ethical, it's not right. I should not do this to my fellow man. I wouldn't want him to do it to me, and that's why I'm not permitted to do it to him. Okay? That sounds like a rational, ethical proposition. Interestingly enough, that's not the proposition of the Torah. In other words, in that proposition is a good one if you want to establish a society. It's what the philosophers call the social contract, which means like this. We have to coexist. I can't steal from you, you can't steal from me, otherwise we're going to have problems. So we set up a system and we say, look, you know, I'm not going to harm you, you don't harm me. That is not really what the violation of stealing is in the eyes of the Torah. In the eyes of the Torah, it is a different concept. The concept is right here from this verse, that we only are entitled to partake of that which God gives us permission to partake of. In other words, we must abide by God's system. Now, God gives each human being certain rights, okay? And he is the only one that can allot the rights to his creatures, because he's the author of the entire universe, and therefore he is the only one in a position to say what each creature rightfully deserves. So the reason why I can't take something which is belongs to someone else is not because I can't harm the other person, is that would be between me and my fellow man. But it is more than that. It is I have no rights which were not given to me by God. Okay? So just like Adam the first had no right to eat anything unless God gave it to him, so too I have no right to take something which God gave someone else rights to. All right? So the importance of this derivation is really profound. What it is saying is that justice has to be based, in the eyes of the Torah, justice has to be based on God. You cannot have justice without God. The idea of justice, of not stealing from someone else, is only possible, really, with God. Because since God is the author of all, and I can only partake of whatever he allows me to, just like he said to Adam the first, I am giving you permission to eat from these trees, which means I can only eat from that which I have permission. So too, with regard to stealing, I cannot take something from someone else because that other person was endowed with rights to his possession, and if I take it something from him, I'm violating what God gave me a right to. He limited my right. He said, you only have a right to yours. You don't have a right to his. Now, if there are many people that have tried to work out an ethic without God. That's a very popular subject today because there are many people that deny God's existence, and yet they don't want to believe that if you deny God's existence, that that means they're barbarians because that means they could do anything. What's going to stop them? So they want to say that, well, we aren't religious, but we still are ethical people. So the question is, well, why are you ethical if you don't believe that there is a God? So they'll say, well, ethics is a matter of common sense. I'll say, well, what is the common sense? So they'll say, well, if I am not ethical to my friend, he's not going to be ethical to me. So we all have to live in harmony. So we have to be ethical to each other. Now, on the surface, this sounds very good. But in actuality, there is a serious flaw here that could never be answered. And that is, if the only reason that you are doing it is because the good of the communal good, the bottom line question is, what do I care about communal good? I really only care about myself, because that's the whole reason for this ethics, is that we're saying, well, if we go at each other's throat, we're not going to be able to coexist. Okay, fine. But if I'm living in a society where everyone is abiding by the law because of the social order, social structure, but if I can get away with something, so so why shouldn't I? There is no logical reason that would prevent me. On the contrary, the whole reason that I am partaking of this social order is for my own benefit, because I'm saying, if I steal from you, you're going to steal from me. So the bottom line is a selfish motivation. Well, then if I invent a crime where I can, the so-called perfect crime where I can get away from it, get away with it, so then there is no logical reason to stop me from doing it. And that is the fallacy of all these systems that try to introduce ethics without God. It's a logical impossibility. You will never be able to show why I, as an individual, if I can get away with something, why I should abstain from doing that. Okay? And the same thing would be true with murder and any other conduct which is antisocial. There is no way logically to prove or to demonstrate that if I can get away with it, that I should abstain. There's no reason for it. The whole reason I'm entering this agreement is for myself to begin with. So if I can get away with it, let everybody else be law-abiding. It's wonderful for me, but in this instance, I can get away with doing what I want. And there's nothing in the world that could stop me. The only logic that could stop me is that God exists. He is the author of everything. He assigns to everything its proper place. And therefore, a breach of that designation is a breach in God's system, and the system which is designed by God, that is the reality that God gave us. That is the only logical form of justice that is possible. Once one denies God, ipso facto, by the very same reason, he is denying any kind of ethics or justice. And I'm not speaking about a person who would, for instance, promote a Darwinian ethic. Say, well, according to Darwin, I could argue, well, survival of the fittest. So I could simply reject the entire thing and say, look, if I am more powerful than you, then on the contrary, that this is the way nature works. I'm not even going into that possibility, which certainly is one that, in its own right, is impossible to destroy on logical grounds. But I'm just saying, even if you would accept the fact that we have to coexist, even then there is never any way to stop me from doing something for my own sake if I can achieve that without any harm to myself. The only logic that is possible is because God exists and he has assigned roles, and therefore it's a breach in the law of nature. That is the concept of injustice. Okay? So, this is a, here we're dealing with, getting back to the question before, philosophical, psychological. This is a philosophical principle. And that is what the Talmudic scholars are deriving from the verse. They're saying over here we can deduce from this very principle, we can deduce the law of theft. Why? Because what is the violation of theft? It's not simply harming your neighbor. It's more than that. It is violation of God's order, God's given order. Now, where do we see in this verse that God creates a given order? How do we know that? Maybe God doesn't care. So there we see when God said to Adam the first, I am assigning all the trees over to you, that means God creates the given order. He is concerned about man having a given order, and he created such an order, and that is precisely the very concept of theft. Theft means you're breaking that given order. So there we see an important philosophical principle, and through the Talmudic analysis of this verse, we come to a concept of justice, which is in reality the only logical concept of justice. A denial of God is a denial of any rationale behind justice or ethics. This one piece of Talmudic analysis teaches us that concept, and that is that theft is basically a violation of justice. Justice is a violation of a given order. The only one that can give an order is God. So that's why there can only be intrinsic justice if there is an author behind the system. That author is God. Without that, there is no concept of justice. So this component of the verse, while it's not speaking about theft per se, because there was no one else in the world that Adam could steal from at the time, but But the concept of theft is there, namely that God assigns roles and God assigns to each individual an area of operation, and theft is a breach of that assignment. Okay, that is a philosophical principle. Now let's take the last one. That was law number 6 from this verse. Now the verse, the last part of the verse, the last phrase, it's a verb, and the verb is eat, to eat. You may eat, but again in Hebrew, it's you have the infinitive first. Eating, you may eat. Now whenever there is an addition, the addition is always there for a reason. And over here, again, when the Torah says eating, you may eat, there's a reason why it puts the infinitive before it. Now, the reason is because it is restricting. In other words, when there's overemphasis, overemphasis indicates restriction. Why? Because it says there's no reason. God should have simply said, you may eat. From all the trees of the garden, you may eat. Eating you may eat is an emphasis, which implies that when God emphasizes and says, eating you may eat, it means to say that there is something, there is a further qualification of what you may eat. And the qualification is that which is fit for eating, you may eat. Okay? The concept here is that the violation of, and this throws the entire law of not eating from the limb of a living animal, not even from the limb of a living animal, it throws it into a different perspective again. A certain philosophical concept is being expressed here. And you'll see, it's an interesting concept. It gives a different idea altogether of the law concerning eating from the eating a limb from a living animal. And let me explain what it is. The fact that you have the redundancy is a restriction, because there's no reason for the extra infinitive before that. The restriction works as follows: it's God is saying to man, eating you may eat. That which is designated for eating, you may eat. Okay? Now, here what God is saying is as follows. That an animal, when it is alive, okay, has its own designation. Its designation is to live, to reproduce. As it says in the beginning of Genesis, God blessed the animal kingdom also, that they should be fruitful and multiply. So they also have functions. We aren't the only ones that have designations here on this planet. But God gave animals designations also. He said that they should be fruitful and multiply. So therefore, an animal during its lifetime is a functioning living organism which God has endowed with a designation. Okay? That's why God said the extra word, you may eat what? You may eat that which is fit for eating, okay? But you can't just arbitrarily eat anything you want, okay? So here, what the Torah is teaching us is the concept, and this is what the Talmud is deducing, is extrapolating from the verse, that the concept of not tearing the limb off a living animal and eating it really is not, again, it's not, see, where most people understand, it's kindness to animals. Now, I'm not saying that is not a benefit of the law, but that is not the essence of the law. The essence of the law is really more philosophical than that. The essence of the law is again tied to the concept that God is the author of everything. And he is the author of the animal kingdom. He gave them designations, and you have no right to break that designation. So as long as the animal is alive and is a functioning organism, you cannot interfere and you cannot eat it, because it is not in the status of eatability, so to speak. Okay? It is not edible in that state. You can only eat that which is in in the edible state. But the living animal is not in an edible state. It's in a functioning state, and it has a designation from God, and you cannot break that designation. Okay? Now, with this analysis, you see that the concept of not eating the limb of a living organism is not just simply a matter of being kind to animals, okay? It's a lot deeper than that. It really, a person who would do such a thing is not just a person that was cruel to animals, but he's a person who has broken God's designation to the animal kingdom. And there is such a designation. Again, it's based on the concept of God being the one that permits man to engage in certain activities which he has preordained, and we have no right to violate the area of function and operation that he has created for us. So now, the concept of the limb of a living animal emerges as something different than we would have thought. At first sight, it's very appealing to say, well, it's kindness to animals. That's very simple. But we see there is a far deeper concept behind it. Okay. With this, we can understand also very nicely, very smoothly, the verses in Noah with regard to this prohibition. Because if you remember that, in Noah, where that's in Genesis 9, 3, and 4, there was originally God stated that man should eat the grass of the fields, which means that he was restricted to vegetation. Okay, he was not permitted to eat of the animal kingdom. He was not permitted to kill an animal in order to eat it. Correct? Then later God removed that restriction after the flood. And that is in verse 9, 3, where God says every creeping thing, everything that moves, everything that's alive, everything that has life, you can eat. And God...
Remember?
Yes, you
got
to turn over.
No, not yet. I'm going to run the time out, then you get to start talking on the other side.
Okay.
All right, two things before you go to chapter 9.
Okay.
If I carry the logic through that you stated on the verse in 2:16, that eating that which is fit to eat,
yeah. And
then you concluded with the fact that you cannot... just kill animals, et cetera,
right.
Et cetera.
That's right.
All right. Now, there are two things I would see there. Number one, the first thing, you would have to have the proper animal. Which animals were acceptable to be killed and eaten and which
okay.
were not.
Okay.
Number two, then you'd get into the laws of Schechter of how to do it.
Right. Okay. I'll expand on that, but...
Because see, you can't have part of that without having can't have the part that you said without having this second and third part.
Okay.
Because it one what you say demands the other two.
Okay.
All right. So at this point we shall flip the tape.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Okay. So. Let me just continue with this. I just wanted to show how naturally these two verses in Genesis 9, 3 and 4 work together. You see, the concept of, man was not permitted to eat, to kill an animal, okay? That can be derived from the very same verse, because it says, God said to man, that which is edible, you may eat. That which is fit for eating, you may eat. But in that verse, it doesn't really say what it is that's fit. Of course, to Adam the first, it states previously that you shall eat the grass of the field, meaning the vegetation. Okay? So man was required to respect the function of the animal kingdom and never to interfere at all. That's the way it was at first. He was not permitted to kill an animal. A dead animal he was permitted to eat, but he was not permitted to interfere with the animal kingdom, because that God preordained that they should have a certain kind of existence on this planet, and you can't interfere with that. That's not your designated area, okay? Later, after the flood, God rescinded that, and he said, everything that is alive, you can eat. I gave it to you just as the grass of the field. But, and the next word in verse 4 is, but you cannot eat something which has its life blood in it, which means while it is alive. Okay, the blood is always, the blood in the Bible, people always look at it as a mystical thing. It's not a mystical thing at all. Whenever the Torah says, whenever the Bible says that the blood is the life, that is simply a fact, and every biologist knows that, that the blood is that which carries all the oxygen and all the nutrients and removes the impurities from the cells. Okay, that's simply a biological fact. The heart is important, but the heart is just a pump. The thing that, that which really gives life is the blood. The blood is the lifeline. The blood does everything. The heart just simply is a pump to pump the blood around. But the blood is that which gives the nutrients, gives the oxygen, removes the impurities, and the blood is the lifeline for the organism, because it supplies every cell with its needs. And that's what the Torah means by blood. It's not a mystical concept. It's simply a biological fact. So the Torah is saying, as long as its lifeblood is in it, which means it is alive, so then you are not permitted to partake of it. However, the implication is clear that, see, the two verses say like this. First it says, everything that is alive you can eat, and then it says, but while it is alive you cannot eat it. Now, what does it mean? It means that you have permission to kill it. In other words, originally you had no permission to kill it because you had to respect its designation in a full measure, which means you can't interfere at all with the animal life. Later, God said, no, even though it's alive, it's under your jurisdiction, but not, you can't eat it while it's alive. In other words, you have a right to kill it, okay? That was given to man after the flood. So the law of the law of not eating the limb of a living creature is really a remnant, or it is a reduction of the original, represents a reduction of the original concept. But it is still the same concept. However, God said to man that man is not capable of this serious, it is too much for him to abstain and just live off vegetation, so therefore he gave man the right to kill the animal, but not while it is alive, because while it is alive, it is a functioning organism, and then you have no right to break its designation. Okay? So therefore, 3, 4, and 9 fit in beautifully. The concept, and this is where most people who are familiar with Bnei Noach don't understand it. They think it's just being kind to animals. It's not a matter of being kind to animals, although that is certainly a benefit that we derive. You know, when we speak about the commandments, we say there are many benefits that are derived from commandments, but you have to understand the essential concept. The essential concept is that we have no right to break the order that God placed us in. And when God designates our function, that's the function. Just like with regard to stealing, we have no right to take someone else's property because that is what God designated. The same thing over here. God designated the animal kingdom, and you have no right to interfere. But how much do I have a right to interfere? So there we have a difference. Before the flood, we had no right to interfere at all with the animal kingdom. Just had to eat vegetation. If an animal died, fine, but we had no right to kill the animal. Whereas after the flood, God reduced it, he modified it, and he stated that you can kill the animal, but you still cannot take its limb while it's alive. Then it's still under my designation, and I did not permit you to do that. Okay? So now we see Eiver min ha-chai, the law of the prohibition of removing a limb from the living animal, as an outgrowth of the original law, which was not to kill any animal. Okay? But it is a reduced form of the original law, but the same concept. Okay, now the question is, what can one eat and how does one kill it? Okay, The answer is really found in the verse itself. And again, with every, you know, we have an oral tradition of how to understand the Torah, but you can never go against the written word of the verse itself. You cannot, through any or through oral means, go against the verse itself. The verse has to make sense the way it is written. And the verse in Genesis 9:3 states clearly, everything that moves, which means every living creature, you can eat. So it is clear that there is no restriction whatsoever with regard to anything that's alive. For insofar as the insofar as Noah and his sons were concerned, there was absolutely no restriction. Now, we did not have to eat everything, and certain things are distasteful to people, like worms or whatever, but there was no prohibition on that, because the Bible states clearly, everything that moves you may eat. Now, everything that moves includes every living thing, and that's clear. One cannot, you cannot talk away a verse, no matter the oral law studies the verses, but never contradicts the written word of the verse. Okay, now, that's the principle we have. We say in Hebrew it's called Ein HaMikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto. The written law never loses its plain meaning. You can make deductions, concepts, draw from it, and there is much more than appears to the eye when you just look at the written law. When you delve into it and you analyze it, you see much, much more. It is a very deep system. It's God's system. But you cannot negate the words of the Torah itself. And here the word, it states clearly that everything, every kind of living thing is permissible. So there is no violation. Now, again, the question is, how do you kill it? So it's quite obvious that since it says, as long as it is alive, okay, that the law is that as long as it is alive, you cannot eat it. So it's quite clear that the moment death takes place, no matter what the method is, it becomes converted to something which is edible, okay? So that's why there is no, as a matter of fact, this is something which I mentioned before. What makes food permissible for the Ben Noach is not the same process that makes food permissible for the Ben Israel. The process that makes food permissible for the Ben Israel is the Shechita, which is a specific kind of slaughtering. The process that makes food permissible for the Ben Noach is simply death. Okay? Doesn't matter how the animal died, because it just says in verse 9, but, and flesh with its life blood in it, you shall not eat. Which means to say, as long as it's not alive, it's permissible. It does not state anything about how to, there's no statement, the permit, in other words, that which makes it permissible to eat is simply the fact that it is not alive anymore, no matter what the method. Now, I think I may have mentioned before that there would be a difference in halacha, and the Talmud mentions this, that, for instance, this will be a case where the Ben Noach would be stricter than the Ben Israel, where usually it's the opposite, but in this case it comes out the reverse. For instance, if an animal, once they sever the trachea and the esophagus with the sharp knife of the shochet, so after that moment, the animal is permissible to be eaten, because that is what permits the Ben Israel to eat it. However, the Ben Noach has to wait until it actually dies. There are many times there's a few moments there that the animal is still alive even after the incision takes place. So during those moments, the Ben Israel would be permitted to partake of the food. Of course, this is a hypothetical case, but it's just to show you the difference. The Ben Israel will be permitted, whereas the Ben Noach would not be permitted until the animal actually dies. Okay, so that's basically the conclusion with regard to this position in the Talmud, which shows how the seven laws are derivable from this remarkable verse that breaks down naturally into seven components. As I said before, the importance is not just the derivation, but the concepts that we came across in understanding the verse itself. Now, I will, if you have any questions, I'll take them now. If not, I will go further. Okay.
Okay. You know, this is one of my little favorite little passages here.
Okay.
Explain the last, number one, the word moving.
Okay.
And secondly, to keep it in the context that everything that every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, even as the green herbs have I given you all things.
Right.
So there's obviously some kind of play going on there with something. So explain that aspect, the moving and the green herbs, before we get down to the flesh with the life in it.
Well, and what exactly do you want me to explain?
Well, I just
the literal translation.
Yeah, just tell me what it means, because okay. You know, I've read the descending, the minority reports on this, and I have a tendency to lean toward the minority report rather than the majority report.
Okay.
On that passage. And then the third thing that you said, that when the throat was cut,
yeah,
for the Ben Israel, he was able to partake. I think you mean there that at that point he can start cutting the flesh away, but he can't eat it until it's salted. And
Well, he can eat it raw.
He can eat it raw without any salt, even if the blood's not drained completely yet.
That's right.
You want to
explain that? I can explain that.
Well, yeah, do that after the first two, because I don't think you've ever taught us that one, because we've always been told that you had to salt it and do all the other stuff.
I can explain that too, but... All right,
okay.
Now the verse in the verse in Genesis 9:3, the actual translation is every moving thing. The word remes really means creeping, moving, anything which perambulates, which moves on the face of the earth. And then it says, so that clearly indicates every kind of animal. That term is the all-inclusive term for everything in the animal kingdom. So the verse is clear that it means every living thing. Now, when it says, I gave it to you as the grasses, what it means, again here, the reason why the Torah says this, a very good reason why the Torah says this, and it fits in line exactly with what we've been explaining, which means God is reemphasizing that you cannot eat anything unless I gave you permission. And before God, in the beginning of Genesis, God gave man permission to eat from all the grasses. That's in Genesis 1, verse 29, I believe. Okay, behold, exact same language, behold, I gave you every grass that procreates, that's on the face of the earth, and every tree that has fruit. Okay, so there God says, I am designating this for you for eating. Again, in line with the Talmudic explanation that you cannot eat anything without God's designation. All right, man would have to starve philosophically, unless God gave him permission, but... God did give man permission to eat, and we only eat with the idea that God gave us permission. That's the concept of a bracha, by the way. The main idea of the bracha, of making a bracha before eating, this is so misunderstood. I always hear people say, well, the rabbi has to bless the food. We don't bless food. Food does very well without our blessing. What we do is we enunciate the fact that God gave us the right to eat from this, and without that right, we cannot eat anything. So that's a philosophical concept. We can only do that which God has designated. Fortunately, God has given us the right to eat food, but that's only with His permission. Okay. There, this concept really is derivable straight from the verse itself, because God says that now I'm giving you permission to consume every living thing, just like I gave you permission before. In other words, I'm extending my permission. What I said before was limited. Now I'm giving it an extension. But the extension goes so far, it does not extend to the animal while it's alive. Then it's under my designation, which is to function as a living organism on this planet, and you have no right to interfere with that function. Okay? So there we have the philosophy behind the law of the law, which people always find very strange, by the way. You know, people who hear about B'nai Noach immediately say, well, most of them sound okay, but what's this taking this limb from the living animal? How's that fit in? What is that? Like, suddenly kindness to animals comes in here? Like, what is that? No, if you understand it in a philosophical way, you see it's a very deep concept, and it fits in there. It's a very important one. It's a basic philosophical principle. Namely, we have no right to just run across this planet, take everything we want. We are not in control here. Whatever we do is based upon God's designation. He created an animal kingdom. He restricted our ability to interfere with the animal kingdom. We cannot just rampantly take anything that we want. And that is a basic philosophical principle in our relationship with God. So the Ben Noach, that law, which seems out of place, is really very, very much in place. And it is the most basic law with regard to man's relationship to God. That whatever we do is because God has given us the right to do it. He determines what our rights are on this planet, vis-a-vis our fellow man. In other words, that he has possession and we have possession. We cannot take that. That's not our right. And we have no right to interfere in a certain level with the animal kingdom as well. It's an important principle. Very basic. Okay. And that's clear again from the verse in 9:3. That verse makes sense. Now, the point that David mentioned with that, which may sound a little bit shocking, and that is, I said that Ben Israel is permitted to eat right after the slaughter, technically. No one would do such a thing, but we have to understand the technical law as well, even though it's a hypothetical case, but there's a concept behind it. And technically, the Ben Israel is permitted to eat the animal the moment the shochet knife, the incision, has been made in the animal. Now, the question of salting the meat. Salting is only a law with regard to cooked meat. Okay? If a person would eat meat raw, there's no need to salt it. Okay? That is a halachic phenomenon, which a lot of people are not aware of. If you barbecue meat, for instance, of course there's no reason to salt it either. There's a custom to salt, just, you know, not to forget the idea of salting, but the law of the Torah is there's no violation. If a person barbecues meat, there's no reason to salt it. Or if he eats it raw. The blood that is prohibited is only blood that would take place during the cooking process. It is blood that has gone from one place to another in the meat of the animal. So when you eat it raw, the blood is just eating it the way it is, as is. As is, there's no, you do not need any salting to remove the blood. It's only if you cook it that you're going to need the salting, because it is blood that has moved from one place to another. In the cooking process, the blood will move from its original place and then be fixed in another place. That is the prohibited blood. Don't ask me the philosophy behind it. I'm not going to go into that. But that is the halacha. So raw meat is always permissible, even without salting. That's why I mentioned that the Ben Israel can technically would be able to eat the meat right after the slaughterer has finished his job, whereas the Ben Noach would have to wait until the animal actually died. Okay, it's important to know what there are two permits here. One is death and one is slaughtering, and they are two different permits, again, based upon the fact that God designates the law and gives us the permit. It's important to know precisely what God said. Okay. Any questions pertaining to that? Okay. Yes?
Mr. Buchanan, Gary has one.
You may have covered it, and I may have missed it, but from the passage in Genesis where it talks about the green herb,
right?
Were there any herbs at that time that were harmful to man?
Oh, yes.
And if there were, how did mankind know that? And can you make that same comparison to meat?
Comparison to?
These are meats that's harmful to man.
Yes.
Just like the green herb. Can you make that comparison to those two?
Okay. The question is about harmful things that are harmful to man. When God created the world, He created the world with many different plants, and God's pharmacy out there. I mean, I'm sure everybody's aware of the fact that most of the medications that we have come from the plants, and especially the jungles. And that's one of the harmful things that man is doing by destroying the rainforest and the jungles, where there are many, many plants that Indians and people who live in the wild know that are beneficial, and modern man also has them. I mean, digitalis and many, many things that God created that are medications for man. God did not instruct man as to what those things are, but that is part of the mandate that was given to man, where it says, "Vikivshuha, and you shall conquer it," which means man is to use his mind and his intelligence to understand the creatures. That's why we find Adam the first, that his first thing he was doing was classifying the different animals, studying them, classifying them, and that's what it means when it says he called them names. It doesn't mean he just called them any kind of name. It means he classified them, and he studied them, and based upon his study of them, he gave them different classifications. That was the first scientific approach to nature, and that is mentioned in Genesis. So that aspect was given to man with his intelligence to study nature and to determine which herbs are harmful, which are beneficial for him, which are beneficial under certain circumstances like medications, and which are not beneficial at all, which are completely poisonous. That was given over to man to study. That's man's function, his divine element, which he was instructed to use in order to subdue nature. Okay, in that sense, man has the right to. That was given again, permission by God to subdue nature means to study nature and to avail oneself of nature for human benefit. Okay, it doesn't mean subdue that he has complete jurisdiction of everything. And yes, he does have a lot of jurisdiction, but he also has to recognize that he's limited. But that was completely given over to man in terms of his knowledge. Adam the first was a person that studied nature. As a matter of fact, the Talmud tells us that when Adam the first was driven out of the Garden of Eden. So he saw that nightfall was taking place, and he became frightened, and he said, maybe this is what God meant when he said, I'm going to die. And the Talmud states that he and Eve cried that night, and they repented because they thought that the sun is gone, and he thought that he's going to die, the planet's going to freeze, and he's going to die. But then when he saw the sun rise the next morning, he said, oh, this is one of God's laws. This is a law of nature. And the same thing was true with regard to the days. As the days of the year, as the days started to get smaller and it approached the winter solstice, again he thought that maybe this is a punishment and he's going to die. But then when he saw that the days became longer, he said, this is a law of nature. And the Talmud says that is in opposition to the idolatry. And he made a holiday celebrating the fact that he wasn't going to die, and that this is merely a reflection of God's beautiful system of nature. And the Talmud says that was in opposition to the idolaters who made a festival around that time in December to celebrate the return of the sun god. So, again, it shows us, and this is an extremely important principle, that recognition of God's laws of nature is a part of Torah, and the idolater doesn't enjoy the recognition of the laws of nature. The idolater just looks for forces, mystical forces, and that is really the one of the fundamentals of the idolatrous mind, whereas the Torah mind looks for God's laws in nature, and once he sees that it is a law of nature, he recognizes that this is a beautiful thing that God has created in his infinite wisdom and is expressed in the universe. So Adam the first, when he saw that it was a natural law, he said, oh, this is not a, he was happy to find that this is not a punishment, this is not a, an act of divine providence interceding. On the contrary, this is part of God's natural law, his natural system. And man is commanded to study the natural law and to understand the wisdom of the beauty of the natural law, as the prophets state in many places. The heavens declare the glory of God. That means the study of the universe is something which the which a person is enjoined to do, to recognize the God's infinite wisdom. So this is all part of man functioning with his divine element, and under that rubric, under that category, comes the study of the animal kingdom and the vegetation and biology and the study of zoology and plant life, and all this is the function of man, his ability to comprehend and to understand and to study nature. So God did not give man, did not tell man in that area, did not help man. He didn't tell him what is harmful, what is not. He expected man to have a curiosity and use his intellect to discover and to learn about God's laws and to study nature and to be able to understand it and use it for his own benefit. Okay? That is very much against the common religious emotion. The man-made religions usually frown on knowledge. They just want divine intervention for everything. But that is not the Torah view. Torah view is on the contrary. That is where man really is able to see the greatness of the Creator and understanding the beautiful ideas behind God's universe. That's part of our religion, God's religion. Okay? Any other questions? I think we're about running out of time.
Well,